Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings. I want to welcome everyone to another program, The Cows, and to share constructive information on what racism, white supremacy is, and how it works. As I always tell everyone when the broadcast, I hope the programs are of constructive value. If the information that is being shared here on The Cows is not productive, not useful to you, please invest your time and energy in something else. We do not want to waste time. We want people to be as efficient and effective as possible so that we can replace white supremacy with justice immediately. I want to get right to it. Today's program is following the news. Again, read the newspaper. Read the newspaper. Just following the news, saw reports where a senator pointed out that some other colleagues, other senators, were practicing racism. And my antenna immediately went up, checked out the story. Very interesting, particularly to have a black male senator calling out the behavior of other senators as racist, and went on to say that he was in Albany fighting the evil of white supremacy. Needless to say, that was all I needed to see. I was very interested in speaking with him further to see exactly what he witnessed and what about this white supremacy he is battling with in New York. Contacted his office, and they were gracious enough to set things up and see if he'd be willing to share some of his time with us. I guess for today's program, he is in his third term as the senator in New York. He represents the 21st district in Brooklyn, New York. I'll get more into what happened. This was April 27, not that long ago, just a few weeks ago, what happened at the New York State Senate Finance Committee meeting where all of this conflict went down. Real pleasure to have him on the program to hear more about his views, and just thankful he could take some of his time out of his busy Thursday afternoon to speak with us. Our guest, Honorable State Senator Kevin S. Parker. Senator Parker, are you with us?
Thank you. Hello, can you hear me?
Outstanding.
Okay, good.
Yes, sir, loud and clear.
All right, great.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for taking some of your time to speak with us, sir.
No, thanks for having me. I think there has not been a good opportunity for me to be someplace where people were honestly wanted to be engaged in a real discourse about the you know, the substance of what I was talking about as opposed to the fact that I disrupted a meeting. So.
We are definitely, and again, just grateful that you could share some of your time with us to get more into the issues and get the actual details of what happened and more about your views. I guess before we get started, if you want to give folks any background first about who you are and what you've been doing in your third term.
Right. And actually, just a small correction. I'm actually in my fourth term. I got elected in 2002 and took office in 2003. So I've been representing the 21st District in Brooklyn, which includes Flatbush, East Flatbush, Midwood, Ditmas Park, Kensington, and Borough Park. It's a district that is 57% black, most of which are Caribbean immigrants, which I'm not. I represent the largest Haitian concentration of Haitian people outside of Haiti in the world. It's 23% white, most of which are Orthodox Jews. I represent more Orthodox Jews than any other non-Jew in the state of New York, including five different sects of Hasidic Jews. It's 10% Latino and 5% Asian, including the largest Pakistani community outside of Pakistan. And so I always say I love my district. It looks like Brooklyn. It looks like New York. It looks like America. I've been serving for the last 2 years as the majority whip in the Senate. My job is essentially to create kind of party discipline and you know, kind of deal with some of the legislative calendar issues to make sure the legislation important for the conference and for individual members is actually getting to the floor and being voted on. I sit on a number of committees, including the Finance Committee, the Codes Committee, the Rules Committee. I'm the former chair of the Energy and Telecommunications Committee, but still serve on it. On the Committee of Commerce, Economic Development, and Small Business. I'm on the Insurance Committee and the Higher Education Committee, as well as the Committee on Environmental Protection. So it's busy.
Wow. Wow. Distinguished career, and thank you for correcting me.
Not a problem. Not a problem.
Fourth term. Wow. Yeah, I want to hop right into things. This program, the context of white supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy, and the definition that I use for both racism and white supremacy is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe that such a system exists, and do you think that definition is accurate?
Well, you know, Neely Fuller, you know, teaches us that the only kind of racism that's functional in the world is white supremacy. And so, you know, I've gotten away from the notion of using the term racism in particular and use the term as you do. I'm talking about specifically about white supremacy because that's really what we're, you know, what we find when we deal with this. And specifically as it relates to the things I deal with in the context of state government, part of what you find are systems where there's always been, you know, white men running everything. So if you, again, you know, you look back in January 2009 when the state Senate went from Republican and Democrat, you had Malcolm A. Smith being the first African-American to be president pro tem of the Senate. Everybody who came in that was a person of color and every woman that we brought in was the first time that a woman or a person of color had ever run those areas. So when I became the majority whip, I'm the first African-American. A woman named Ruth Hassel Thompson, you know, from Westchester in the Bronx, was the first woman to be the conference chair, African-American woman, first woman and the first African-American to be conference chair of a majority conference in the state of New York ever. You know, you had, you know, Eric Adams, who's the chair of the Veteran Affairs and another committee on wagering and racing. He's the first African-American ever. Martin DeLon, head of the Senator Martin DeLon from Brooklyn, also head of the Transportation Committee, first Latino. You know, and so in every instance, you know, I think, you know, one of my white colleagues, Toby Savisky, who is the head of the Higher Education Committee, first time a woman had ever run the Higher Education Committee in the history of the Senate in New York State. And so, you know, there hasn't been a lot of diversity as it relates to, you know, the structures that we've been dealing with in the state Senate. And what you've had on the day in question on, I guess, the 27th of April was that we were trying to get one of Governor Patterson's nominees through a committee. The process is as follows. When you get nominated by the governor, you go through a background check, and then you're sent to the Senate for confirmation. It goes to what we refer to as the Committee of Original Jurisdiction in this particular case, because it's Marco Luck, and Mark was being confirmed for the power authority, and went to the Energy and Telecommunications Committee, which I also sit on. And so he began there, met with people there. They liked him. In fact, so much so that when he came to the Finance Committee, which was the next step, the head who was a Republican and also a white male, stood up and recommended him for confirmation first. And, we then had but it took some work getting through Energy and Telecommunications. Then he came to Finance. Actually, originally came to Finance on April 20th. And Senator DeFrancisco from Syracuse asked that he appear. Now, this was unusual but not, unreasonable. And so we allowed him, to appear. When he appeared on the 27th, Senator Mazars, who was the chair of the Energy Committee, got up, recommended him. Senator Mazars is from Buffalo. And, questions started to be, be asked. And, again, that's not an unusual thing. But then Senator DeFrancisco, who was a lauded trial attorney, began to interrogate Mr. Oluck in a way that I had never seen in for 8 years I've been on this committee. I have never seen white, black, blue, or green a person be treated the way Mr. Oluck was treated. And part of the reason why he was treated that way is because Mr. Oluck is African American, also has spent a lot of his time working on women and minority business development issues. And, essentially Senator DeFrancisco had a significant problem with that. And, not only had been critical of other kind of what we refer to as MWBE, Women Minority Business Enterprises legislation that we brought before the committee. But then, like I said, in an interrogationist style, you would have thought this was Guantanamo Bay the way he was talking to him. And like this guy was some enemy of the state. And the chair of the committee, a Democrat, Carl Krueger, essentially allowed this to go on. I then at that point, figured that the rules of the body were not being followed because either by rule or by decorum. And so, I decided that I was going to disrupt the meeting because I just thought that, this person should not be treated this way. We had never treated anybody there. I knew that he was being treated this way because he was black and because the Power Authority, which is an 80-year-old organization that is has business about $3 billion in front of it, had never had an African-American, never had a Latino, never had an Asian on it, had one woman, and she recently has stepped down. And so, this was, as you rightly say, this is the very definition of white supremacy. You can only talk about racism when, other races have a chance of being on top. Anytime that we talk about this system, is always a system, again, as you rightly indicated in your definition, where whites are at the top of the scale and blacks and others are at the bottom. And, in this particular case, again, in the New York State Power Authority had a board that for 80 years looked over, oversaw and shepherded billions of dollars for the state and never, were women, African Americans, Latinos, or Asians ever included in that decision-making power. And the first time that we had the audacity to bring somebody forward who not only, was African-American, but then also, was somebody who had been, had a record of fighting on behalf of women in minority business development and was going to make sure there was some economic equity, shown in this organization, they get attacked. And, and then subsequently from that, people then began to attack me, not because I was doing the right thing, or maybe because it was because I was doing the right thing, but, people don't want to talk about my character and my temper and all these other things. My question to the members of the committee and the members of the Senate is not whether I'm angry or not. The question is, why isn't anybody else angry? The question is, how long do African Americans and Latino and women and Asians have to be left out in the cold from economic opportunity in the state before anybody gets upset about it? How do you take, 60-70% of the population, lead them out from 100% of the economic opportunity, and then call that justice, and then no one stand up for that? And then you want to stand up on MLK Day and talk about justice and talk about, dreams and all kind of stuff? That's all they want you to do. They want you to dream. Nobody really wants to stand up and speak truth to power and make sure that the things that need to be done in the state are done correctly. And, I have been serving this body way too long to allow such blatant forms of racism to be demonstrated and not to confront it head on, and not to make sure that the things that need to be done are done. And so as a result of that, Marco Luck was, in fact, confirmed to the power authority, and which I think he would not have been had I not disrupted the meeting, frankly. We got a chance now to actually put this, apparently you've been having this conversation for a while, but I have got a chance to be in front of some mainstream media to, in fact, talk about the issues of that happening in the state as it relates to the lack of diversity and the disparities that we find in labor market discrimination, the disparities we find in healthcare, in education, in housing, that all must be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Again, privileged to have him on the program, Senator Kevin Parker. I guess I wanted to look at some of the details that happened in that meeting, because I was reading different news reports, and Mr. O'Luck, and he, in addition to being a black male, he has been confirmed. He is now a trustee with the Power Authority. Is that correct?
He's on the board of the Power Authority. Correct.
Okay. The issues that Senator DeFrancisco raised, it seemed to focus on a blog report from 2009, and he was asking if Mr. O'Luck, if he authored this report, and he seemed to take issue with some statements. I'll just read exactly what's from the post. He seemed to take issue with the statement that said that these minority and women business programs, when they were not around, white men and the connected would have access to nearly 100% of all city, state, and federal government dollars spent. Before these minority and women business programs came along, non-minorities, I think he means white people, had their own affirmative action program. And it seems like Senator DeFrancisco, he took some sort of exception with that, and
he
felt like that.
Gus, let me give you a little clarification. So you're right. This is a blog posting, and the first question was whether Mr. O'Luck wrote this. And now, mind you, by the way, we were aware that Senator DeFrancisco had some concerns, and so although the meeting was on Tuesday, April 27th, Mr. O'Luck came to Albany by his own expense on Monday, April 26th, and met with every member of the Finance Committee, including Senator DeFrancisco, for over an hour. And so this subject matter that we're discussing, this was not the first time that Mr. O'Luck had seen it or that Senator DeFrancisco had come across it. He had asked him about him a day earlier. And so, so the questions were asked 24 hours prior to this, and they had had, like I said, a meeting for over an hour. And then for me, it was clear to me that Mr. DeFrancisco was doing nothing more than looking for an opportunity to embarrass the nominee. And one of the questions he kind of focused on was whether it was written or not, and he kind of harped on this for a while. And essentially, what we get down to is that Mr. Luck was at a meeting probably a year and a half prior to the confirmation. So this is 08 sometimes. There was some kind of meeting or a conference or something he was at where he actually made a statement, and somebody took a statement and then blogged it. So then the question was, did you write this? And he said, no, I didn't write this. I didn't blog. I didn't put it up on the internet. No. And then he said, well, did you say, it says your name. He says, yeah, it says my name. And yes, the statement is attributed to me. And I don't deny the statement, but I didn't put it up on the internet. I think that's fairly clear. That was a half an hour kind of on and on and on and on. And this is the part where just by form and by custom, the chair of the committee really should have stepped in and policed the committee. But again, as you talk about system, international systems, global systems, this is how the global system happens. It doesn't necessarily mean that you actually have to go out and do something. People, our problem right now is that people look at white supremacy in the context of things like neo-Nazism and the KKK and those kind of things. individual acts of racism are really less important nowadays. Really, what we're dealing with are the systematic, methods that we have to deal with day to day, and the institutional racism that we have to deal with day to day. It is the labor market discrimination. It is the lack of access to educational opportunities. It's the lack of access to proper health care, and all these things don't have to be are not necessarily done one at a time. Always, there's systems. There are criteria that automatically leave you out. It's things like in the state of New York, the Regents exam, which is a culturally biased exam that we not only bias the students with, but we're biasing the teachers with it too, because we're trying to connect the success on the exams with the success of teachers. This is how the systems work to disadvantage whole groups of people simultaneously. And so, he had all these questions, about who wrote it, and it was just really just not an appropriate line of questioning to go on and on for over half an hour about. And certainly the chair of the committee should have been doing his job and should have stepped forward and interrupted it and made sure that the nominee was protected from harassment and from belligerent questioning by Senator DeFrancisco.
Wow, that's very important, because I don't think that appeared in any of the reports that I read, that Senator DeFrancisco had an opportunity to meet with Mr. O'Luck previously and chat about any of these concerns. I don't think that was reported in anything that I read. I want to ask, for clarification, do you feel that Mr. O'Luck, the nominee, do you feel that he would have been treated differently if he were a white person?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, I've been there for 8 years. I've never seen a white person. Even white people had done, we had a white nominee, Mr. Hammerdinger, who was appointed to the MTA board, who belonged to this club called the Harmony Club, which is a racially segregated club. And he came. People had some serious questions about it. He was hardly even asked a question, let alone treated with any kind of disrespect. I mean, at the end of the day, there is certain kind of, decorum and procedures that one is supposed to follow as a member of the New York State Senate. And one of those is that, we deal with the confirmation of governor appointees all the time. And, essentially, in general, the governor is entitled to his appointees, unless there's some significant conflict of interest or something that's really, really egregious about this person's background or character. You can get them on the record on things. You can disagree with them about policy, but that is not your opportunity to attack this person. And it is again the form and the custom of the Senate to treat nominees with the appropriate respect. And that wasn't done in this case, and I've never seen it not followed, except in this particular case. When it concerned a black nominee going on a very important board.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Our guest, New York State Senator Kevin S. Parker. Senator Parker, again, you can read the reports about this incident. They're all over the internet. I saw a lot of people saying, not talking about, whether or not racism was being practiced, focused on Senator Parker's incredible outbursts. I can't believe his conduct. He's yelling and just being totally unprofessional and the way that he's calling these folks out. Can you talk about the response and how you have handled all of this? I've even seen where people have said that you are racist because of what you said.
Yeah, this has been actually the most craziest part about the whole experience for me is that exactly because in the Obama post-racial society, no one is supposed to raise race. You have a black president, don't ask for nothing else. And so anybody who says that race is affected in a decision, all of a sudden that makes you a racist because you raised the spire of racism. So I've gotten that a lot, and to be honest with you, I've ignored the vast majority of it, because again, this is how the system works, right? And you start talking about how does white supremacy work. You know, part of it is, you know, to make sure that the system, you know, the first function of any system is the maintenance of self. The first function of any institution is to make sure the institution continues to operate in the way that the institution is operated. Frankly, the presence of myself and other Black and Latino and gay members, you know, our presence in the state senate is really a failure of the system, because frankly, none of us were supposed to be there, from the way the system is set up anyway. So the fact that we've gotten there, you should just feel lucky and you should just go along and get along, let alone not, you know, fighting for your people. And so, you know, I've ignored those things, because it's mostly rantings from, people frankly don't matter to me. I thought it was just more important to kind of focus on what my message was. I did think that it was interesting that some of the mainstream media, the New York Times, who called for somebody to run against me and that I was not fit to serve, thought that it was more upsetting and more egregious that I interrupted a meeting for less than 2 minutes than they are upset about the years of, you know, the decades of, you know, lack of opportunity for Blacks, Latinos, for Asians, for women, and, you know, not just the power authority. I mean, no one ever, again, from the mainstream media, ever stepped forward and said, let's look at the substantive part of what Senator Parker was saying. Let's look at what, you know, why he was upset. Let's look at Senator DeFrancisco's behavior, and let's compare it to his behavior when white nominees have come forward. Or let's look at his behavior, since he's been in the Senate, and the issues that he stands up for and the issues he doesn't stand up for. The appalling thing about this is that Senator DeFrancisco represents Syracuse. He represents a city with a significant Black and Latino population. And he has a lot of those people who live in his district. And he doesn't represent them. And that's really that's part of what the problem is. And it's just, you know, the reality is that there are significant disparities as it relates to labor market discriminations. I represent Brooklyn. And as they start talking about, as we're in this, you know, jobs crisis right now in the country, where unemployment is reaching, you know, 20%, in the Black community, generally nationally, it's almost double that. And I could tell you that it's triple that in some places for Black men in Brooklyn, where unemployment is reaching 60-70% in some of the housing developments in Brooklyn. And so, you know, where's the task force? Where's the subsidy? Where's the bailout for Black America? I mean, you know, the banks got bailed out, right? The car companies got bailed out. Where's the bailout for Black America? Where's and, you know, not that anybody's looking for a handout, but where are the jobs? Where's the opportunities for people, to get to work so they can feed their families and take care of themselves? So, you know, and that conversation, frankly, is not happening in a way that's satisfactory to me, either nationally, and it's certainly not happening in New York State or New York City in a way that you would think a progressive state like New York City should be having those conversations. And so I've been really just, and why I'm here today is really to spark that public discourse. Is, you know, the death threats I got and all of the ignorant people, those things are not important to me. What is more important is really to be on a show like this, Gus, with you, to talk about to Black people and to white people of good character, to start these conversations and start talking about how do we address these issues? How do we in fact make sure that when economic opportunities are available, that everybody has an opportunity to get those opportunities, that we make them available for everyone, that everybody has a say in how we dole out money and dole out other kind of resources from the state. And that's what representative government is about, and that's certainly what I think, my role is. And the question is, not what happened to me or what happened because I disrupted a meeting. The question is, you know, what would have happened had I not disrupted the meeting? This would have gone, away quietly in the night, and another Black person would have been denied an opportunity that would have affected other Black people. So, I mean, because Marco Luck's appointment to the power authority was not about him. You know, frankly, it's a volunteer position. He doesn't make a dime from being on this board. But having a person like him on this board will certainly make a difference in the kind of opportunities that Blacks and Latinos and women and Asians have, in the economic success of the state.
Do you, I guess, could you share your view? Because I've seen, as I said, many posts where people, I assume that these are white people, have said, Senator Parker is racist. Do you think it's possible for a black person to be racist?
I think it's possible. I think it is possible for them to be racist. I think it's, you know, it's kind of hard. I mean, I define racism in a little bit different way. I mean, again, I'll go back to what I said starting the show, which is that the only kind of functional racism in the world is white supremacy, right? And we get that, again, from Dr. Francis Cress Welsing and Neely Fuller directly. But, you know, and so when we look at, and what I mean by that is that when you look at these disparities, like you look at health disparities, you look at, you know, prostate cancer, well, white men have the least, you know, so we look at, you know, the health disparities, white men have the least, you know, number of prostate cancer. Black men have the most. You know, you look at educational attainment. You know, white men have the most, the highest educational attainment. Black men have the least. You know, and so it's always, when you look at every single disparity, whites are always at the top. It's the definition of white supremacy, right? And again, it's an institutional and it's a systematic and group power dynamic. And so I think that, you know, theoretically, could a black person be racist? Yes. But the reality is that functionally, black people don't control enough for there to be, you know, black racism.
I guess from your vantage point, in the Senate, how have you seen, you've already shared some of the ways, I'm looking for some of the other ways that you have seen racism, white supremacy manifested during the work as a senator in New York.
Well, let me give you a good example. Under former Governor Elliot Spitzer, you know, he started these, you know, these blue ribbon commissions around everything. And so one of the things he did, you know, instead of going about, you know, when you hear people talking about government and politics, people always think, they say, oh, no, the politics is bad. Politics is only bad if you're not in control of it. You know, understand, government are the buildings. Government is the institutions. Politics is the process by which things get done. And so when people start talking about, you know, this is kind of one of the ways that the system and the institutions work to maintain itself in a white supremacist fashion, is that when they start then talking about, you know, blue ribbon commissions and nonpartisan, that means, you know, to make sure that there's nobody with power. And because now that's the kind of things you start hearing now. Why? Because now you have black presidents, you have in the state of New York, you know, a black governor. You have John Sampson as the black leader of the Democratic Conference of the State Senate. You have, you know, Malcolm Smith as the president pro tem, African American. You have Pedro Espada as the, you know, Latino majority leader. And so when you start looking and start seeing blacks and Latinos and you know, Asians as, you know, John Liu as the city controller of New York City, you know, they're looking for opportunities to mitigate that power. And so what do? You do things through these blue ribbon commissions. So, you know, he wants to take politics out of it, but meanwhile you have a blue ribbon commission. Everybody on the blue ribbon commission is white. They were looking for, I guess this was 2007, they were looking for a judge, a Supreme Court judge out of Brooklyn, and came up with a list of like 12 candidates, and not one black, not one Latino, not one Asian, and not one woman. Right? So those are the kind of dynamics that you start to see, you know, for these quote-unquote blue ribbon commissions. And so, you know, and these, you know, nonpartisan panels. You know, when you hear the mayor then start to talk about nonpartisan voting, you know, you got to ask yourself, what is that about? Why all of a sudden do we need things to be nonpartisan? You know, we've had, you know, one of the greatest democracies in the world, in the history of the world. It lasted almost 300 years, and it's been a partisan system by design. Now, all of a sudden, why are you going to nonpartisan voting? You know, the question is why? And the reality, you go to nonpartisan voting because it then allows people, you know, to maintain the system as it is. And it creates a dynamic where it'd be more difficult for blacks, Latinos, women, and Asians to, in fact, have a seat at the table. And so you have to pay attention to those kind of things. Look at really quickly the state budget and procurement in the state of New York. The state of New York is the third largest budget in the entire country. This is the federal government's budget, then the state of California, then the state of New York. Our proposed budget by the governor this year is $136 billion. Of that, upwards of $25 billion, somewhere between $25 and $35 billion will be contracted out in 2010 and 2011. Right? When you look at that as everything. So remember, the state of New York has to buy everything it doesn't produce itself, everything from toilet paper to large construction projects. Right? And when you look at all the, you know, that $25 to $35 billion they're going to spend in 365 days, less than 2% goes to women, African Americans, Latinos, and Asians. Less than 2%. They represent over 60% of the population combined, but they get less than 2% of the procurement opportunities and the economic opportunities in the state of New York. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. And I know for, you know, me for one, I'm no longer going to sit quietly on the sidelines, particularly in a jobs and fiscal crisis that we're experiencing in this country and in this state, and allow, you know, my people to go hungry in a land of plenty.
Wow. Honorable New York State Senator Kevin S. Parker, a guest on the Cows. When I first heard about this this incident and began to do more research, the thing that popped in my mind was watching President Obama, and I don't have any criticism of him, but it seems that President Obama has had to be very careful in the way that he speaks about racism. He seemed like a lot of people were very upset with him. A lot of white people were very upset with him when he spoke about what happened to Dr. Henry Louis Gates last year. Seems like that's a touchy thing that could botch plans for a reelection or a long political career, talking candidly about racism, white supremacy. Do you think that might have an adverse impact on your long-term career?
I don't really care about let me be honest. When I first came here, I had a lot of ambition for what I wanted to do. And my ambition has been replaced by a deeper love and commitment for my people and what the possibilities are for them. And, you know, I would, you know, second, give up my career and my ambitions if I could advance the cause long-term and make some systemic changes in the way state government runs such that is more equitable to everybody in the state. And, you know, and I say that in a way that I believe with a $136 billion proposed budget, there's enough for to allow everybody to eat. You know, I think that, you know, making procurement more fair is not going to, you know, I'm not talking about disadvantaging white people. I'm not talking about, you know, putting white people in the street or making them hungry or destitute. But the reality is that, you know, we live in a country where less than 10% of the population controls 90% of the wealth. And that certainly ought not to be the case. You know, again, I can't speak for the president and what his goals are. I can just simply say that for me it's far more important for me to make some systemic changes in the way that resources are delivered in the state of New York than it is for me to, you know, win higher office or to be getting some kind of awards. Frankly, I'm getting what I need and deserve by the criticism I get on television and the radio and newspapers. I mean, you know, frankly, I'm going up against the system. So if the system is, in fact, rewarding me, that means, in fact, I'm not doing my job, because it is, in fact, my express desire to change things in the way that government works, and the way it works, well, I should say in this case, doesn't work for blacks, Latinos, Asians, and women in this state. You know, it's important because a lot of people aren't getting what they need. And, you know, some people try to, you know, say, oh, it's just about black people. I'm like, it's not about black and white, because, you know, right now, you know, women, your wife, my mother, your aunt, my cousin, who are women, are now receiving, you know, pennies on the dollar to what men are receiving for doing the same jobs in the state of New York. That's absolutely ridiculous. And we haven't made a pass legislation in the state of New York to, in fact, change that scenario. And again, this is New York State. You know, this is not Montana. I'm not trying to be insulting anybody, but this is not Oklahoma or Montana or someplace where you think, you know, more about more, you know, place in the country that have more, quote unquote, traditional values. You know, this is New York State, you know, the Empire State. You know, we ought to be, you know, we ought to be more progressive. We ought to be, you know, on the vanguard of making sure that people's rights are protected, that we ought to be on the vanguard of making sure that economic opportunity for every single person here are the same. And you know, we've failed in our charge to do that.
Well, I want to take a couple callers before things wrap up, but I did want to ask. I mentioned President Obama, and again, I don't have any criticism of him, and I didn't hear any criticisms from you either. But I am curious. There have been just a litany of incidents reported, seen almost daily, about racist acts, racist comments directed towards not only President Obama, but First Lady Michelle Obama, his children even. Do you have any comments on all of these incidents that just, you know, are nonstop against a non-white person being in the Oval Office?
Well, I'm sure that the president expected it. I think he's more than up to the task. Again, it is, you know, the response you know, of the institutions, and you know, some of the stuff is systemic. Some of it is just, you know, the rantings of just nuts and out society, which, you know, just exists no matter what society you're talking about. I think, you know, I'm actually more concerned than by those. I'm more concerned by the organized attempts by the Republicans during the healthcare debate that were, you know, the burning the president effigy, and you know, this is somebody who's trying to reform healthcare. You know, comparing him to a Nazi. I mean, there's some of the outrageous things that we saw that were clearly organized by you know, some of the conservative forces in this nation, and, you know, and the Rush Limbaughs and the Newt Gingriches of the world. I'm more concerned about their attempts to smear the president than I am about, like I said, the individual nuts that we know just exist in every society.
Okay. Yeah, I did. We had a couple folks that called in. I want to get a couple callers before Senator Parker exits. Someone called in, last four digits, 3441, 3441. If you have a question or two for Senator Parker, your mic is open.
Hello, can I be heard?
Loud and clear, sir.
Well, thank you for coming on the program, Senator Parker. It's been a real pleasure. During your political career, have you ever received death threats prior to making statements about white supremacy?
Only one other time, and it wasn't. It was actually about 3 years ago when I was on CNN. I can't think of the guy's name. He just retired. He just left. But I was on his show talking about immigration. It was actually around the time that the state of New York went back to a policy of not requiring a Social Security number or a tax ID number in order to have a driver's license. And I was on debating one of my colleagues on CNN, and I got a couple of death threats from around the country because of my support for immigrants and the fact that, you know, being able to having people documented was an important actually safety feature, but also didn't help us in terms of things like insurance rates and those kind of things. You know, it was the beginning of some of the debates that we're seeing now around, you know, around Arizona. But yeah, those times were the only two times I've gotten death threats.
Okay. What were the nature of the death threats you received after you made the statements about white supremacy? You know, some details.
It was actually a couple of different ones, but most of it just was one was threatening me and the president, and you know, just saying how horrible we were and that we ought to be killed and, you know, watch your back, that kind of stuff. Just kind of the normal, just threats, nothing spectacular. And like I said, I paid very little attention to it because I'm really not trying to focus on, you know, two or three letters or phone calls that we got. But like I said, the larger question is not about the death threats. The larger question is about the systematic and institutional disparities that we see in our societies around health, housing, education, labor market discrimination, and how we in fact address those things. And that's really more of the conversation I want people to be engaged in.
Definitely, I agree. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Someone called in. Their number is blocked. Can't see him. But if you called in and you have a hand up and you have a question for Senator Parker, your line is open. Person that called in with a blocked number, you have a hand up and you have a question for Senator Parker, your line is open.
Yes, Senator Parker, can I be heard?
Yes.
Yes, thank you for coming on the show. I know that you have a tight schedule. You were talking about the ways the dollars are allocated through contracting and procurement in the state of New York and how you wanted everyone to have the appropriate opportunity to get those dollars. Have you ever proposed that the persons who need the most help should receive it? And if you have, what has been the reaction? If you haven't, what would you anticipate would be the reaction of your colleagues?
Well, we actually have a number of initiatives. One is referred to, just to use the article number, it's called Article 15A. And it's Article 15A of the Economic Development Law for the state of New York, and it actually requires that there be women and minority business development goals for economic development projects in the state of New York. We're actually looking at some legislation. I've been working alongside of Senator Ruth Hassel Thompson, Senator Antoine Thompson from Buffalo, Senator Andres Stewart-Cousins from Yonkers, around making sure some of this language comes into the 2010-2011 budget. And then we also have some other pieces, some companion pieces that we're looking at. Be quite honest with you, as we've put MWBE ideas forward, we have actually gotten a great deal of resistance, both not just from Republicans, but also from Democrats. And it's been surprising because, like I said, when you look around the state of New York, the state of New York is not a state where black people live in one area. Like, everybody has black people in their district. Everybody has Latinos in their district, you know. Everybody has women in their district. I mean, you know, the 61% of the state is 58% of the state population is female. Like, you know, so it's really surprising to me, and when you look at the numbers, to have so few, even white women, competing for economic development dollars. It really provides a disadvantage for some of the neediest populations in our state.
So if you could call to mind specific phrases or language, if you can, you may not be able to, that has met the most resistance that would support the principle of the people who need the most help receiving it, what specific language has met that kind of resistance?
Language around making sure that women and minorities have access to economic opportunities vis-a-vis contracting in particular. In addition, when we have tried to put, when we have tried to deal with state boards, commissions, and task force that deal with economic issues and making sure that there are appropriate diversity on those boards, we've gotten a lot of resistance, you know, in those particular areas as well. Either through just questioning or, you know, long floor debates or long debates in committees. The new tack by the Republicans is to say, well, we need to, you know, aren't most of these businesses small businesses, so shouldn't we help all small businesses? And the reality is that small businesses generally are struggling a little bit in the state of New York as they are around the country. But the reality is that white male small businesses are, you know, when you compare them within the context of their cohort, white male small businesses are way you know, outlasting small businesses by blacks, Latinos, Asians, and women. And so, you know, it's important that we make special provisions to help women and minority business enterprises because they have absolutely the worst time getting access to state contracts and opportunities for economic opportunity, economic advancement in the state.
I see. If I could just ask one other question, it's a real quick one.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with any of the work that has been done by the economist out of Duke University? His name is a black economist. His name is William Darity.
No, I'm not. Sorry.
I would encourage you to maybe get in contact with him. I think that
okay.
might help you in your work because you might be able to raise it in what they call race-neutral language, which is helping the people who most need help, and that is inevitably going to be people who are not white.
Yep.
But there are ways to quantify that and actually get that information before them. And I think it would be very difficult for even people who call themselves white and call themselves Republicans to oppose.
I really appreciate that. I'll definitely look that up.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming on the show.
No, thank you.
We have one last caller, if you have time for one more. Last caller also has a block number, so I can't call out number for this one either. Called in with a block number, and you have a question for Senator Parker. Your line is open. Other person that called in, you have a block number showing up. If you have a question for Senator Parker, your line is open. Okay, I'm assuming they're just listening, perhaps, which is fine too. Thank you for listening in. Well, I learned a lot, and I must say I'm very impressed. I don't think I've heard too many folks say that they are more interested in justice and doing the correct thing as opposed to making sure that their career is long and full of great rewards and a great salary. That is a rare thing to hear from someone. I would love, please tell my listeners anything you would like to say before we close things out.
Well, let me say, although you've already heard it from me, there are actually a lot of my colleagues, black and white, Latino, Asian, who believe the same thing, who are actually more concerned about doing the right things in the state than their own career. There really are a lot of them, or not as many as we like, but there's more than a handful. And I just think that we're in a unique time. I think that in this Obama presidency period, where people are trying to define it as being post-racial, we need to be at the forefront of making the president do the things that we need him to do. I think that if we sit back and wait for the president, to do things that are going to provide economic justice and racial justice for us, that we're going to be sorely disappointed. That we need to push him as hard as we would have pushed him if he was white to do the right thing. We need to push President Obama to do the same thing. And likewise, people ought to be, in contact with their legislators and their elected officials. Even when you disagree with them, when you don't think that they're doing anything, the reality is that, I got into government because government affects every single aspect of our lives. If you eat a hot dog today, there is a regulation, unfortunately, that tells you how many, parts of a rat could be in that hot dog, or how many roach, parts could be in there, to, what's in the construction materials, even, the form of communication we're using right now to talk to each other is all regulated by the government. We regulate almost every single aspect of people's lives. And so it's really important that your elected officials hear from you, and that they know that you're concerned about these issues of economic injustice and your ideas for how they ought to be righted no matter where you are in the United States. And just lastly is that, we have to, remember, we're at war and we are the resistance, and that the world, will not be changed by a whisper. So we need to raise our voices and change the world.
Wow. 21st Senatorial District Representative, State Senator Kevin S. Parker, honored to have you on the program, sir. You have an open invite to come and share your views with us anytime. I wish you continued success. Please keep up the excellent work, and I will definitely be watching what you're up to, sir.
Thank you very much. I look forward to coming back and sharing more about what's going on in the state of New York.
Thank you so much for having an excellent day, and I wish you luck in the upcoming elections.
Thanks. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, our guest today's program, Honorable Senator Kevin S. Parker, 21st Senatorial District, Brooklyn, New York. Man, that's wild. When as soon as I read the phrase, he was talking to a white reporter, I almost put the video up on today's program. He was talking to, I think she's white, he was talking to a white reporter, and she said she was upset about, the comments that he made in this meeting, and he stopped her and he said, whoa, there's only one functional form of racism, white supremacy. I said, wow, I think this guy has read Mr. Fuller's book, and lo and behold, yep, he has, and Dr. Welsing, apparently. I would hope anybody out there, if you're interested in writing anything about racism, white supremacy, doing any work, doing a film, anything, do it. You never know who will access your material. Could end up being a non-white person ends up getting to the White House or anything. They can end up getting anywhere, and because they read your material or heard your material or whatever you produce to counter racism, white supremacy, it affected their thought, speech, and action, and they carry that forward in whatever they happen to do in the future. Still very surprising to know that there is a sitting senator who is openly calling out racism, white supremacy, familiar with the code, and Senator Kevin S. Parker, very, very interesting. Take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. Context of white supremacy.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? At counterracism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Gus T. Renegade, Justice, the Context of White Supremacy. I hope that was constructive, informative for non-white folks. Not doing full two-hour show. Senator Parker, a very busy guy. Didn't want to, and actually, he didn't even give me a time limit. His press representative, Ms. Mkonde, excellent, she said, you know, he's very media friendly. You know, as long as you're not going to be talking to him all day long, he'll be more than happy to sit, chat, and answer questions. So, yeah, I definitely would appreciate the opportunity to have him back on the program. Glad I got him today, and will definitely have my eye on the newspapers to see what's going down in New York, in Brooklyn specifically. Just very interesting, the whole story. I might amend the description to this program to include some of the videos and reports about the incident that happened, because they have video of this incident that happened in April with Marco Luck, that is the black male who was being nominated to the Power Authority Committee. So you can see everything that happened. You can see the white person, Senator DeFrancisco. You can see the questions that he asked the gentleman for almost a half an hour, as Senator Parker said. You can see all the questions that he asked. And it all pretty much centered around these statements about how white people had a system of affirmative action, and still do, the system of white supremacy. That was what it was all talking about, basically the system of white supremacy, racism. And you can watch all of this, you can hear it, you can see for yourself, you can see how Senator Parker responded. All of that is online. I think I will amend the description so people can see the footage for themselves, and you can see some of the reports. You can see how this incident was covered in the news media. People, like I said, people calling Senator Parker racist, you know, saying he blew a gasket and he needs anger management classes and all of this other stuff. The death threats that he spoke of, very, very interesting. And a lot of material online. This is pretty current. This just happened a few weeks ago. At any rate, we will be back on Saturday, May 22nd, Anthony Pryor, Anthony E. Pryor. He is a former standout professional football player. He starred at actually Washington State. I found that real ironic. We were talking on the phone, and he realized I was in Seattle, Washington. But yeah, he attended Washington State, was a standout Division I NCAA football player, went to the NFL, Canadian Football League. He played for the Minnesota Vikings, New York Jets, Oakland Raiders, and has published several books. The book specifically we're going to be focusing on for Saturday's program, The Slave Side of Sunday. He also has a book that is about to be published, and that is called Black Horses, White Cotton, and Religion. Man, cannot wait. Saturday, it'll be Saturday evening, 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Pacific, Anthony E. Pryor, The Slave Side of Sunday, and Black Horses, White Cotton, and Religion. That'll be this Saturday. Very much looking forward to it. He too, I don't know if he's read Mr. Fuller's book or Dr. Welving's work, but he does seem very informed about racism, white supremacy. He uses the term white supremacy, so that always kind of lets me know how informed a person or how honest they're willing to be just looking at the words that they use to describe racism, white supremacy. In addition, we'll be back on Sunday as well. Kevin Annette, he is a white man, and he does a lot of work on how so-called Native Americans, First People, have been abused by the system of racism, white supremacy. I think he focuses more on Native Americans in the area of the world known as Canada, but that's, you know, global system. He'll be here. He has a documentary film called Unrepentant. It is online. You can view the whole film. I will most likely link it in the description so people can check it out and watch that if you want to be prepared for Sunday's program. I suspect I also will be doing a program on Sunday evening about the Boondocks. As I said, I'm real excited. Jimmy the Rebel, upcoming program, Jimmy the Rebel on the Boondocks. Uncle Ruckus apparently finds a racist country western singer, and it goes from there, apparently. Jimmy the Rebel, that is the new episode of the Boondocks, airing this Sunday, May 23rd. We'll be doing a broadcast after that episode airs this Sunday, so it'll be Sunday evening, I suspect, 3 a.m. Eastern, so technically that's Monday morning, 12 a.m. Pacific, still technically Monday morning. To chat about the Boondocks, other trends that I've seen in the episodes, and specifically what goes down with Jimmy the Rebel. Very excited about that program. Cree, she called in. You heard her today. She called in and shared the information, very constructive, about William Darity's work. He was just on her program a few weeks back. You can check her archives. And she will be broadcasting. Excuse me. She'll be broadcasting tomorrow. Friday, May 21st. Excuse me, I'm sorry. She'll be broadcasting tomorrow, May 21st, 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Pacific. She will have Michelle Alexander. She is the author of The New Jim Crow, all about the so-called prison industrial complex and the greater confinement that black people, non-white people are subject to in the system of white supremacy. I'm going to take a drink here. Excuse me for one second. Okay. Non-alcoholic drink. But yes, Cree, Counter-Racist Evolving Engineer, her program again tomorrow. Michelle Alexander, Greater Confinement, her book, The New Jim Crow, should be very constructive. The times, again, 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Pacific, Counter-Racist Evolving Engineer, right here at Blog Talk Radio. Support her blog as well, Cree7, cree7.wordpress.com. Again, cree7.wordpress.com. And Back of the Bus, support his blog as well. Back of the Bus, nonwhitealliance.wordpress.com. Again, nonwhitealliance.wordpress.com. That's Back of the Bus's blog. Yeah, I can lay out Memorial Day weekend. Cows will be very busy. We've been pretty busy for the entire month of May. I believe this is program number 10 for May. We will be very busy. If all of the programs go down as scheduled, hopefully that will be the case, but if everything goes down as scheduled, this should be the lineup for Memorial Day weekend, which is next weekend, Thursday through Monday. This should be the lineup. It should be Thursday, so a week from today. That would be the 27th. Rafael Scheck, I believe I'm saying his name correctly, Rafael Scheck. He is the author of Hitler's African Victims, talking about the Negroes who get left out of the history books who were also victims of the system of white supremacy in Nazi Germany. He'll be here next Thursday afternoon. On Friday, we will have Mark Potok, I believe I'm pronouncing his name correctly as well. He is one of the lead investigators for the Southern Poverty Law Center. We'll be talking about, they have been tracking the Southern Poverty Law Center. They've been tracking the increase in death threats and racist white supremacist organizations pretty much since the election. So for about not quite 2 years, I guess about a year and a half or so, they've been tracking the rise in these, I believe they might use the term hate groups, but racist white supremacist groups, and the rise in racist activity in general. They've been following all this, the Tea Party protesters. We'll be discussing all that next Friday. Mark Potok, he is, again, one of the lead investigators for the Southern Poverty Law Center. That'll be next Friday. Saturday, Dr. Martin Kevorkian returns. He'll be here Saturday morning. We'll be talking about films. I think we will be doing, in addition to some other things, we'll be talking about those five films that Dana R. Carney dropped on us when she was here. The five films: The Matrix, Green Mile, Pulp Fiction, As Good as It Gets, and Shawshank Redemption. Those five films, comparison, contrast, and I can tell you there are some blatant themes of racism, white supremacy. And again, these films were presented as race neutral. These films were presented as, you know, there's no blatant racism here. You know, these films are okay. They've got a black male lead, all of them, so no problem, right? We'll be talking about those five films and other topics. That's program number one for next Saturday. Program number two for next Saturday, we should have, in addition to having Mrs. Gwen Ragsdale make her return trip to the Cows, we should also have her husband, J. Justin Ragsdale. They are the co-curators of the Lest We Forget Museum. It is the Museum of the Black Holocaust of Slavery in this area of the world. Mrs. Ragsdale was on the program just a few weeks back. She shared great information. She didn't have as much time as she would have liked to chat with us. I let her know that some other people had called in and wanted to ask her more questions, and she said she would love to come back and to have her husband. She was kind of bummed that her husband wasn't here to chat with us as well. So her husband will be here as well. That'll be Saturday evening. Hopefully that'll be constructive. Looking forward to having them together. Sunday, that's next Sunday, not this coming Sunday, but next Sunday, that is May 30th, program number one, Dr. Tamara Knopper. I have been persistence, trying to get her on the program since last summer. If you check on the web, she has a lot of articles, essays that she writes a lot about racism, white supremacy. She uses the term white supremacy. She is a so-called Asian female. She indicated that she specifically wanted to talk about the black, non-black divide. She indicated that was something that she's focused on a lot more right now. She wanted to talk more about that on the program. groovy. I'm all down. Should be fun. Looking forward to that. That's program number one next Sunday. Program number two, Timothy, the return of the admitted white supremacist known as Tim Wise. That should be program number two next Sunday. And capping Memorial Day weekend, Monday, May 31st, the return of the irritated genie. He will be here a week from Monday, so that's May 31st. He'll be here. We'll be talking about some of his videos, racism, white supremacy, and media, feminism. We'll be talking about that. I suspect you'll hear some of the information that Mr. Macko talked about when he was on the program yesterday. That's May 19th. If you didn't catch that program, you can go back, catch the archives. He talked quite a bit about feminism and pedophilia, homosexuality. Very interesting. And very much, very similar to a lot of the things that the irritated genie shared when he was on the program in April, and should be connected to some of the things he's going to discuss with us when he comes back May 31st. So that is the full slate, everything that's lined up for Memorial Day weekend. No holidays. Working hard, kind of counter-racist grind. I did want to share. I was thinking about reading because I had talked about the importance of reading and kind of getting better, refining our techniques when we read, talking about black people specifically right now. Some of the other things that I wrote down about reading, I know people say, because I used to be, you know, same boat, that, you know, it's difficult. You know, on the plantation of racism, white supremacy, you are worked very hard, you're mistreated, you just don't have the mental energy or even the interest sometimes in having a grueling day in the cotton fields, in the office, dealing with racist white supremacists or suspects. You just don't feel like, you know, coming home to read. I totally understand. I can relate. What I used to do when I didn't have as much time and energy to read, what I would do was at least try to find books that I wanted to read. Try to find books that, you know, this is something that I should read. This is something that I want to read. If I had more time, I would be reading this book. I would go out and just get those books. Either if I was purchasing, I would just go to the bookstore, get those books, and just pile them up, kind of build your little library. And I mean, it doesn't have to be elaborate. You know, it can be 10, 15 books, right? Just get those books so you have them there. You have access to them. They're in your home. They're in your place, your residence. Have them there. When you do have the time, now that's not an excuse. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to worry about my library card and all that other stuff, or the library doesn't have what I want to read. You already have books right there that you can read. That was when I used to do the most reading, when I was in between jobs or, you know, whatever, not working, not on the plantation as much, and I was broke, didn't have money. Hey, I can sit at home and read. Doesn't cost anything for me to sit here and turn these pages. Plus, I'm stimulating my mind. I'm staying active. I always felt it was better for me because I wasn't just sitting around watching television or, you know, just goofing off. I was keeping my mind active and just staying constructive. At least I could say I'm learning something. I'm reading. I'm learning. I'm you know, I've read 3-4 books. I can talk, you know, I can talk with other people about what I'm reading. It's not just me sitting around watching television, sleeping all day, being lethargic since I don't have to be at work. But that was one thing that helped me a lot. And I got really into it because I had the time. I had books that I wanted to read. It was no problem. I was flying through books. I would read quite a bit. Once I was in between jobs and had that time, I would read quite a bit. So that would be one suggestion I have. Also, you can get smaller books. I know for a lot of people, I was talking about how we will start reading a book and then not finish it. You don't have to go and get War and Peace, right? You don't have to go get the 1,000-page book, the 600-page book. You don't have to go get the biggest book to start, right? Thing that I noticed about me, you will get better. It's like anything else. Playing basketball, cooking, driving, riding a bike, anything else. The more you do it, you refine your skill, right? So the more you read, you will get more efficient at reading. You'll know more words. You will expand your vocabulary. Your pace will quicken. And it'll probably be an unconscious thing. You won't even really take note of it. It'll just be something where you notice after a while, whoa, I'm reading a little bit faster. It used to be that I, you know, could read 20, 30 pages in an hour. Now I'm reading, you know, 40, 50 pages in an hour. It'll be a real subtle thing, but your speed will increase. Your comprehension will get better. You will refine as you go. So just keep that in mind. You don't need to start with the biggest book. You can start with a smaller book. And they're great books. You know, don't think just because it's a smaller book, don't think that that means you're missing out. They're great books on anything, really. They're great books on racism, white supremacy that are not very long. Robert Jensen, he's been on this program twice. One of the books that he authored, The Heart of Whiteness, it's great. He's a suspected white supremacist, but that book is great. He talks about the importance of terms. He actually supports and encourages the use of the term non-white over the term people of color. He talks about white supremacy. He uses the term white supremacy. He talks about why he does not like discussions of so-called diversity. Very good, and it's not very long. I think it's maybe 100 pages. Not very long at all. That might be a good starter book. Anybody, if you're out there and you're not accustomed to reading a lot, you don't like reading, you don't have a good relationship to school and reading, and you're trying to change that, that might be a good one to pick up. It's easy to read. It's not one of those that's got a ton of big words. It's easy to read, and it's not very long. You can read maybe 15, 20 pages a day, and you'll be done. You'll be done with the book in a week. Let me see if I can think of some other books that are not very long. Dr. Baruti. Dr. Baruti's book on sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people, Excuses, that's the title of it. That one is not very long. I think it's it might be 150 pages. It's not very long. There are books out you can get that are on the smaller side so that you're not, you know, intimidated by the book, and then just slowly, you know, build up as you get more accustomed to it to picking up books that are a little longer. No problem. What are some of the other tips that I had? The same thing that I said about as you continue to read, you will refine as you go. You will become a more efficient reader as you continue reading. You will adjust to the author. One thing I've noted about myself, it takes me a little while. Every person that writes, they have a different style. They have a different way that they write. They have a different way that they try, that they convey information. It takes me a little while to kind of lock in on an author's style of writing. Maybe takes me about 50 pages or so. After that, even I can notice a difference even after those first 50 pages. I can read a lot quicker once I pick up how that person writes. And I think that's I suspect it's true for a lot of other folks who read as well. Bibliographies. I talked about footnotes the other day. Bibliographies, very important. Bibliography, you can just flip to the back. Even if you say, you know, I don't want to look at the footnotes, that's crazy, it's small print, you know, man, I don't want to do that. Just look through the bibliography. If you read a book, and see what other books that person read. That bibliography really gives you a ton of fine details about how that person constructed this book. That's pretty much telling you all of the other people's work that they're standing on to put their work forward. As I said, I've made whole programs out of just looking at the footnotes and the bibliography for books that I've read for authors who've been on this program. I can give you an example. Frank Wu's book, Yellow. He was on the program August of 2009. Just reading the footnotes and the bibliography, I was able to get Thomas Shapiro, Hidden Cost of Being African-American. I first found out about him reading the footnotes for Frank Wu's book. From Frank Wu's book, I also got Dr. John Hoberman, who did Darwin's Athletes. very interesting. Both of those books, I would say, very interesting, learned a lot. In fact, I might even say that I enjoyed both of those books a little bit more than I did Frank Wu's book. But if I hadn't read Frank Wu's book and read carefully, looking at the details, the footnotes, bibliography, I wouldn't have got those two books. And I think it might have been some others. Frank Wu's book was very detailed. John Patas, his book, I picked up several other books just from reading through the footnotes of his book. I'm not remembering his name off top, but the gentleman who did the book on the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. That book is not coming to me now, but it's in the archives. He was here in December. That book I got from John Patash. There's another book as well that I picked up from just carefully reading the footnotes for John Patash's work. And he had a ton, as I said yesterday. He had like 50 pages of footnotes. But, yeah, very important. Read the footnotes. Read the bibliography so you can see other works that this person is citing that's relevant. Most likely it's going to be relevant. It's going to be very similar to the material that you're reading, generally speaking. Let's see. Pay attention to the chapter and the title. Very important. Pay attention to the chapter, individual chapter, names that are given to chapters. Or sometimes they'll have sections, and then those sections will be broken up into chapters. Pay attention to the titles that are given to those. A lot of times that should be like a nice blueprint of where we're going in this book. The title chapters and all that should tell you exactly what you should expect for the next few pages. As long as you're in this chapter, all of this should be around the idea of whatever that title is. Generally, that's the way it goes. That can be a quick way to kind of jog your memory about what you're looking for, what you read. If you forget, that should be an easy way of walking through the book, if it's done in a cohesive manner. Now, some people don't title their chapters. Some people are not very good writers. This is not going to always apply. But generally speaking, that should be a way to kind of help you stay focused and be aware of what you're supposed to be getting out of the book on the whole and what you're getting from the book from that specific chapter. Very important. Pay attention to the titles that are given to chapters, individual sections. Pay attention to that. And the whole book. Everything should be around the idea of whatever the title of that book is. Important things to keep in mind. Again, words are important. Words are important. That title is there for a reason. The title of the chapter is there for a reason. Pay attention to all that. Paying attention to those details can really help you extract more meaning from the material. Let's see. And last one I had. If you could just read 20 pages, I say try and get a number, right, that you say, well, I'll just at least do 20 pages. And if you set out a goal and say, well, okay, I'm going to read 30 pages per day. And something happens, it's a tough day on the plantation, and you're tired, and, you know, you got called some names, white person, you know, made some snide comments about you and cut your hours for the day or whatever. So you had a tough day on the plantation. That's to be expected. You come home, you don't feel like reading, and it turns out the white supremacy signal was up real high. So you come home, every non-white person in your house also had a bad day. So everybody's mad, and you're just trying to avoid conflict and just get in bed before it gets worse. I don't want to read. I've had a bad day. I just want to be left alone before I, you know, go crazy and have a white supremacy stress reaction and bop somebody. If you can just read, hey, I'm not up to reading what I intended to read. I intended to read 30 pages. I'm not up to that. I can do 15. Maybe I can do 15 or 10. I'm just not up to 30. Do the 15 or the 10 pages. Do the 15 or the 10. It's much better to at least get those 10 or 15 in as opposed to saying I'm not going to read anything at all. Number one, when you start taking breaks from reading, it's like anything. You get a rhythm. We are creatures of habit. When you break that rhythm and you've been reading every day and then you stop, it can throw that rhythm off. It makes it a little bit easier to not pick that book back up, and then you're not reading the whole book. So you want to try not to break that rhythm, number one. Number two, if you can just get 10 pages, and I use this principle myself all the time. I have to read a lot of books to do the show. Got to read a book for Saturday's show. Got to read a book for Thursday's show. The days that are tough for me when I don't get all the free time that I should have to read, or when other things happen, or white people stress me, and I say, well, I just don't feel like it, or I just don't want to do it. I'm done reading. I don't want to read anymore, or I just would rather be doing something else. I at least try to make myself read 10 to 15 pages, because I would much rather have, if I got 50 pages left to read, I would much rather get up the next day and be looking at 35 pages because I went ahead and read 15. Even though I planned to read more than that, I would much rather get up the next day and say, well, I got 35 pages to read because I at least did read the 15. I didn't read everything I was supposed to read, but I at least read the 15. I would rather get up and have that 35 pages as opposed to not reading anything and getting up and having 50 pages to read. See what I'm saying? At least for me, I have found that to be beneficial. Just even if it's just a little bit, that's good. That's good. It keeps you engaged with the book. It keeps it fresh in your mind, so you're thinking about it. You're thinking about the ideas in the book. It keeps that rhythm going, and that's a little bit less that you have to do. It's a little bit less. It's just reading is about patience. I think some of the other factors that contribute to black people not reading, reading requires patience. I see a lot of black people. I think white supremacy conditions us to be very impatient. Instant gratification. We're not very good at delaying gratification and just being patient about things. Reading requires patience. Reading requires quiet. Not a whole lot of noise. I think you hear Mr. Fuller and Dr. Welsing talk about the noise in environments that have a high concentration of black people. Reading, I mean, the library is quiet for a reason. You to think about the words that you're reading and what the author or authors are saying, kind of need to be in an environment that doesn't have a lot of distractions and craziness going on. I guess it's good that I said that. It's very rare that I will read with music on, headphones on, any of that. I don't do any of that. When I'm reading, I generally, it's a quiet environment when I'm reading. Even if I'm outside, it's quiet. I find a quiet spot outside. If I'm in a library, it's already going to be quiet. If I'm in a house, quiet. I try to find a quiet spot away from everybody so I can just read and I don't have anything else stimulating my mind except the words on the page. Very important, I think. I could be incorrect, but very important. So, I guess I would add that in addition. Try not to have other things, the television and music and a whole lot of distractions going on when you read, and patience. Patience is very important. I think, you know, people look at a huge book and say, oh, my gosh, I can't read all that. You're not supposed to read it all in one day. You know, or you don't have to. You don't have to read it all in one day. You don't even have to read it all in 3 days. You know, you can take a month if you need to. You know, it's not a race. It's just you and the book. Go as fast as you need to, as fast as you want to. Go as slow as you want to, you know. And sometimes when I got to where reading was more enjoyable, sometimes I enjoyed taking my time with it. I didn't want to sprint through it and see, you know, I'm going to see if I can read this book in 2 days. I wanted to take my time because if it's a book that I was enjoying, I really wanted to sit there and make it like a meal, make it last, and enjoy each page and overstand it as much as possible. So that would be my few tidbits on reading. I hope the information that Senator Parker shared was important. I found it very interesting and informative. It might not be, though. Might not be. Again, we will be back Sunday, May 22nd. May 22nd, Anthony E. Pryor, very much looking forward to the program, author of The Slave Side of Sunday and Black Horses, White Cotton and Religion. That will be Saturday. Hope folks will tune in if they find the broadcast to be constructive. Thank you so much for tuning into the program. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. And justice, her email address, justice.asap@yahoo.com. Again, justice.asap@yahoo.com. Thank you, everybody. Back on Saturday. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately.